November 30th, 1963, West Hollywood, California. After not being heard from for over 2 days, the nude body of 22-year-old actress Karen Kupsinant is discovered on the couch inside her apartment. Her death is initially suspected to be a drug overdose, but when the coroner discovers a broken hyoid bone in Karen's throat, he rules that she was a victim of strangulation. Years later, Karen's death would be linked to conspiracy theories surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and allegations that she made an anonymous phone call to warn people of his death minutes before it happened. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and that sound clip you just heard was from the 1961 comedy The Ladies' Man, and it's probably the only time you'll ever hear audio from Jerry Lewis on this podcast. The reason I played that scene is because it happened to be the screen debut of actress Karen Kupsinant, who would die under mysterious circumstances only 2 years later, and is the subject of today's episode. And there's a reason I selected her case. The release date of today's episode is November 22, 2017, which happens to be the 54th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. As you might have heard, never-before-seen documents related to the assassination were released to the public for the first time ever, so of course debates have flared up again about whether there was a massive conspiracy surrounding JFK's death, or if Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole perpetrator. Well, this episode is not going to be analyzing the JFK assassination, because that would require several weeks' worth of episodes. Instead, we're going to be focusing on the unsolved death of Karen Kupsinant, which occurred less than 1 week later. Under normal circumstances, there shouldn't be any reason to link these two events, but to give you an idea of how far-reaching the JFK conspiracy theories go, there are some people who believe that Karen Kupsinant was murdered because she knew too much about the assassination. But regardless of whether you believe it has any connection to JFK or not, Karen's death is still a pretty intriguing mystery in its own right, and well worth exploring from all possible angles. However, before we get started, just a brief reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the mysterious death of Karen Kupsinant. Our story begins in West Hollywood, California in 1963. Our central figure is 22-year-old Karen Kupsinant, who originally hails from Chicago, the home of her parents, Irv and Essie Kupsinant. Irv Kupsinant, who usually went by the nickname Cup, was one of the most prominent and recognizable figures in Chicago, as he was a gossip columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times for several decades, hosted his own syndicated TV talk show, and worked as a radio announcer for the Chicago Bears football team. Karen used her influential family name to break into acting before moving to Hollywood and making her screen debut with a bit part in the 1961 Jerry Lewis comedy, The Ladies' Man. Over the next 2 years, Karen's acting jobs would mostly be guest spots on television shows, and her final role was on an episode of Perry Mason, which did not air until after her death. After doing a guest appearance on the TV series The Wide Country, she became romantically involved with the show's star, Andrew Prine. However, even though Karen wanted to settle down, get married, and potentially start a family with Andy, he did not wish to make the relationship exclusive and wanted to keep dating other women. In July of 1963, Karen was pregnant with Andy's child, so she traveled down to Tijuana to have an illegal abortion and was accompanied by her friends Mark and Marcia Goddard. Mark Goddard was also an actor, who would go on to play the role of Major Don West on the TV series Lost in Space, and he paid for Karen's abortion. Karen's personal life in general was in a tumultuous state at this point, as she always had an obsession with her weight and was abusing diet pills, along with other prescription drugs. On the evening of November 27th, Karen attended a dinner party at the Goddard's home in Beverly Hills. Even though the dinner was scheduled to start at 6:30 p.m., she arrived over an hour late. According to the Goddards, Karen barely ate anything and mostly just played around with her food. She also looked like she might be under the influence of something, as her pupils were constricted, her lips seemed numb, her voice sounded funny, and she was moving her head around at odd angles. When Mark confronted Karen about this, she started crying before sharing an odd story about finding an abandoned baby on her doorstep earlier that day. According to Karen, after she contacted the police, they came and took the baby away. Since the following day was Thanksgiving, Karen was invited back for dinner, but she told them she and Andrew Prine were planning to spend the day at the home of actor Glenn Ford. Karen called a taxi to take her home at 8:30, and she promised to phone the Goddards later. After returning to her apartment in West Hollywood, Karen was visited by one of her friends, a writer named Edward Rubin, and they watched television together. Karen apparently had a pretty state-of-the-art television set for 1963, so her apartment was often a popular hangout for her friends to watch TV. Karen went outside for a quick walk, and wound up bumping into another actor friend of hers named Robert Hathaway, so she invited him up to the apartment. The three friends continued to watch TV together until Karen started falling asleep on the couch, and she decided to head into her bedroom. According to Rubin and Hathaway, they weren't entirely sure if Karen had gone to bed, so they lowered the volume on the TV set and exited the apartment at around 11:15, claiming that they made sure to lock the door behind them. On the evening of November 30th, Mark and Marcia Goddard became concerned because Karen had not phoned them in 3 days, so they decided to visit her apartment. The front door turned out to be unlocked, so the Goddards let themselves inside, and were shocked to discover that Karen's nude, decomposing body was lying face down on the couch, with flecks of blood on her face and a nearby pillow. The television set was on, and playing at a very low volume, just like how Rubin and Hathaway claimed they left it. The apartment appeared to be in a state of disarray. A half-empty cup of coffee was resting on a stand, a coffee pot and a brandy snifter full of cigarette butts were found on the floor, 16 cigarettes were strewn around the couch, and there was an overturned lamp. A bathrobe was laid across a chair in the living room, and a towel was found on the bathroom floor. When police were summoned to the scene, they found a number of rambling notes throughout the apartment which Karen had written. The notes contained sentences like, "I'm no good, I'm not really that pretty, my figure's fat and will never be the way my mother wants it, why must I be so alone, what's the use of living with nothing to believe in, there's nothing, only phony motives, selfish egoists, selfless people, fat heads, and drunks, and I want out." Karen also left behind a note listing famous people she liked, including President Kennedy, and this would turn out to be somewhat prophetic, but we'll get into that a little later. The content of Karen's writings could be interpreted as a potential suicide note, and some troubling things about her would soon emerge. When Andrew Prine was questioned, it would turn out that Karen spoke to him on the phone on the afternoon of November 27th, where she told him the same story she shared with the Goddards about finding an abandoned baby on her doorstep. Andy claimed he called Karen back at midnight after arriving home at his apartment, and she told him she'd called the cops, who took the baby away. Since this phone call took place after Rubin and Hathaway left Karen's apartment, this would turn out to be the last time she was confirmed to be alive. However, the police had no record of ever picking up an abandoned baby from her place on November 27th, and found zero evidence to indicate that Karen's story was true. There was another disturbing revelation when police discovered a pile of magazines in Karen's apartment, which had been shredded and cut up with scissors. During the preceding months, Andrew Prine had found a number of threatening messages on his doorstep, which were assembled together with letters and phrases which had been cut out of magazines. When Andy told Karen about this, she claimed she had been receiving the same threatening messages on her doorstep and even showed them to Andy. Well, investigators started looking into these notes and found numerous fingerprints on the paper and on the scotch tape which was used to assemble the cutout letters. 1 year earlier, Karen had been arrested for shoplifting some books and clothing. While she only got off with a fine and 3 years probation, her fingerprints were still on file, and they turned out to be an exact match to the prints on the paper and the scotch tape. So yes, this meant that Karen had cut up the magazines and assembled all the threatening notes before sending them both to Andy and herself. A search of Karen's diary also revealed that she had been keeping records of Andy's encounters with his new girlfriend, which meant she had been spying on them. It was clear that Karen had not reacted well to Andy's decision to date other women and seemed obsessed with rekindling their relationship. Andy also confirmed that he did spend Thanksgiving at Glenn Ford's house, which is where Karen told the Godards she would be, but both actors denied that Karen was invited to their get-together. In addition, Karen had told her family that she was not traveling back to Chicago to spend Thanksgiving with them because she had work to do on Perry Mason, but this also turned out not to be true, since the episode she appeared in had already been filmed. So there was a lot to indicate that Karen was a very troubled woman, a notion which was reinforced when 13 bottles of prescription drugs were found in her medicine cabinet, including Desoxin, Miltown, and Ambisil. Many of these bottles were either empty or half-empty, so the initial belief from most people who knew Karen was that she had either taken her own life or was the victim of an accidental overdose. However, the case went in an entirely different direction once Karen was examined by the LA County coroner, Dr. Harold Cade, who estimated Karen's approximate time of death as 12:30 a.m. on November 28th, only about a half hour after she last spoke with Andrew Prine on the phone. According to Dr. Cade, Karen had a broken hyoid bone in her throat and enough damage to her neck to indicate strangulation. Therefore, he officially ruled that Karen's death was a homicide. So this prompted the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to launch a murder investigation and start looking at potential suspects. Well, at the top of the list was Andrew Prine, as investigators wondered if he might have killed Karen in a rage after finding out she had been sending him threatening letters and spying on him. Well, it turned out that Andy's alibi witnesses just happened to be the last two people to see Karen alive. After leaving her apartment, Edward Rubin and Robert Hathaway claimed they went out for a drink at a bar before heading back to Hathaway's duplex, where he just happened to be neighbors with Andrew Prine. Shortly after they arrived, Prine decided to stop by to hang out with them, and all three men claimed that they chatted and watched television together until 3 a.m. Prine, Rubin, and Hathaway were all extensively interviewed and investigated as possible suspects. They each took polygraph tests, which came back inconclusive. The one major red flag occurred when they were re-interviewed 3 years later, and Rubin changed his story, claiming that he and Hathaway went their separate ways at the bar after leaving Karen's apartment, and that he spent the night with two women he met there, rather than going to Hathaway's apartment. But otherwise, there was no evidence to implicate any of them, and in their defense, the coroner believed that Karen was strangled by a left-handed person, and none of the three were left-handed. Another potential suspect was an aspiring actor named David Lang, who lived in the apartment directly below Karen's. On the night of Karen's death, Lang had gone out on a date with Natalie Wood, who, ironically enough, would suffer her own mysterious death 2 decades later. Lang claimed he was drunk and returned to his apartment at 12:30 a.m., the estimated time of Karen's death, but went straight to bed without hearing anything unusual. Well, a few days later, Lang allegedly told a friend that he killed Karen, but when questioned by police, he claimed he was just joking. Lang had a history of erratic behavior and was known for drunkenly entering other people's apartments without being invited, but no evidence tied him to Karen's death. When police dusted the apartment, they did find fingerprints belonging to Edward Rubin, but none of the other three suspects, and a couple of prints they found could not be matched to anyone. Well, within the next few years, the investigation into Karen Cupson's death would go into a place no one ever expected. At the time Karen died, the United States was still reeling from one of the biggest tragedies in their nation's history, as President John F. Kennedy had been assassinated while riding in his motorcade through Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22nd. Lee Harvey Oswald was identified as the assassin who fired the fatal shots, but as you well know, many people have always believed there's a lot more to this story, and the Kennedy assassination has been the subject of more conspiracy theories than any other event ever. Well, no one had any inkling that there might have been a connection to Karen Cupson until 1967, when an author named Penn Jones Jr., known for being one of the very first Kennedy assassination conspiracy theorists and heavy critic of the Warren Commission's report, released a self-published 4-volume book about the event titled Forgive My Grief. Jones believed that the conspiracy was so large that over 100 people connected to the assassination died under mysterious circumstances in the ensuing years. One significant event chronicled in this book occurred in Oxnard, California at 10 a.m. Pacific time on November 22, 1963. A switchboard operator received a phone call from an anonymous woman who spoke in a low whisper and claimed that the President of the United States was going to die in 10 minutes. She started rambling on and uttering cryptic statements like, "The Justice, the Supreme Court, there's going to be fire in all the windows, the government is going up in flames. The government takes over everything, lock, stock, and barrel." So the operator got one of her co-workers to listen in on the call. At some point, they thought they heard the woman put the phone down and dial another number. When the operator asked if she needed assistance, the woman said, "No, I'm using the phone," and then stated that the president was now going to die at 10:30. The call finally ended at 10:25 Pacific time, and within 5 minutes, President Kennedy would be dead, as the fatal bullet struck him at Dealey Plaza at 12:30 p.m. Central Time. The call would be reported to the FBI later that day, who believed that it had originated from the Oxnard area. Now, it's certainly possible that the anonymous female caller was a crazy person, and that it was nothing more than a massive coincidence that she predicted Kennedy's assassination, but the fact that she got the exact time right raised a few eyebrows. Kennedy's motorcade was originally scheduled to arrive in Dealey Plaza at around 12:10 p.m. Central Time, or 10:10 Pacific Time, which was the woman's original prediction, but there were delays, and the motorcade got held up about 20 minutes. Since the operators thought they heard the woman attempting to phone someone else during the call, was she somehow finding out about the motorcade's delay, which prompted her to change the time of the president's death to 10:30? Well, believe it or not, Penn Jones Jr.'s implication was that the anonymous female caller might have been Karen Cupson, who was attempting to warn people about the impending assassination. If you're wondering why a 22-year-old actress in California would even have knowledge of something like this, Jones's theory is that Karen may have learned about it from her father, Irv Cupson, aka Cup. You see, during the 1940s, Cup became acquainted with a guy you might have heard of named Jack Ruby, who subsequently moved from Chicago to Dallas in 1947 and became a nightclub owner. On November 24, 1963, 2 days after President Kennedy's assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald was in the midst of being transported by police when Ruby shot him to death on live television in front of millions of people. While the Warren Commission concluded that Ruby acted alone when he killed Oswald, conspiracy theorists have always believed that since Oswald was set up to be the fall guy in Kennedy's assassination, Ruby was assigned the job of silencing him before he could reveal anything incriminating. Penn Jones Jr. believed that the Mafia somehow learned that Ruby told Irv Cupson about the assassination plot, who subsequently shared this information with his daughter. But Karen tried to warn people and stop the assassination, so the Mafia had her killed in order to send a message to her father to remain silent. Well, of course, Cup believed these claims were absolutely ridiculous and staunchly maintained that neither he nor his daughter had any knowledge of a conspiracy involving the Kennedy assassination. Andrew Prine claimed that on the evening of November 22nd, he and Karen traveled to Palm Springs with two other friends, and that even though Karen was visibly upset by JFK's death, she gave no indication that she knew anything about it beforehand, or that she'd attempted to warn people about it earlier that day. The two phone operators from Oxnard also stated that the anonymous female caller sounded like she was an older, middle-aged woman, and not a 22-year-old like Karen was. 38 years later, Oliver Stone released the controversial hit film JFK, which drove home the message that President Kennedy's death was the result of a massive conspiracy. Irv Kupcinet was a vocal critic of the film, and in February of 1992, Kup became particularly upset when the Today Show published a list of mysterious deaths connected to the Kennedy assassination and listed Karen Kupcinet's name. This prompted Kup to publish an angry column in the Chicago Sun-Times in which he expressed his disgust and maintained that his daughter's death had nothing to do with the assassination. In the years following Karen's death, her parents seemed certain that Andrew Prine killed her, and Essie Kupcinet even waged a personal vendetta against Prine and attempted to destroy his reputation. Prine's acting career wound up suffering for a little while, but he eventually recovered. He is still alive today at the age of 81, and has amassed a large filmography with over 180 credits. In 1988, Irv Kupcinet published an autobiography and stated that he no longer believed Prine had anything to do with his daughter's death. Kup now believed that the prime suspect was David Lange, and believed that Lange's wealthy family used their influence to prevent him from being properly investigated until his death in 2006. While Lange's acting career never went anywhere, he wound up working for acclaimed director Alan J. Pakula, and even co-produced Pakula's 1971 thriller Clute, which earned Jane Fonda an Academy Award for Best Actress. Irv Kupcinet passed away in 2003 at the age of 91, 2 years following the death of his wife Essie. Karen's brother Jerry Kupcinet is still alive, and is a successful television producer who actually took home a Daytime Emmy for his work on Judge Judy. But unfortunately, after 54 years, there are still no concrete answers about the unsolved death of Karen Kupcinet. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, like I said in the intro, even though this case has a tentative connection to the Kennedy assassination, it is not the main subject of this episode. If you go online and delve into the conspiracy theories, you'll find many lists of quote-unquote mystery deaths, as dozens of people connected to the assassination supposedly died under mysterious circumstances in the ensuing years. You'll often see Karen Kupcinet's name at the top of these lists, because she died only 6 days later, so aside from Lee Harvey Oswald, you could infer that Karen was the first loose end in this conspiracy which needed to be tied up. I'm not going to comment too much on the so-called mystery deaths conspiracy theories as a whole, because that's way too large of a subject. But I'm pretty comfortable making this statement. The word thin does not even begin to describe the connection between Karen Kupcinet and the Kennedy assassination. In fact, I'd say that the word anorexic would even be too generous. So let me get this straight. Irv Kupcinet and Jack Ruby were acquaintances in Chicago sometime during the 1940s, but even though Ruby moved to Dallas in 1947, and there's no indication that he stayed in touch with Kup at all during the next 16 years, Ruby decides to tell Kup about his key role in one of the biggest conspiracies of all time. So how exactly would that conversation go? Hey Kup, long time no see. By the way, the President of the United States is going to be assassinated soon, and I'm in charge of assassinating the assassin before he can talk. And then instead of telling the authorities about this, Kup decides to tell his daughter, Karen, who becomes very perturbed, but instead of warning someone who actually has the power to prevent the whole thing from happening, Karen decides to travel over 50 miles from her home in West Hollywood to Oxnard in order to call some random switchboard operator about 10 to 20 minutes before the assassination is supposed to occur. The people responsible somehow find out about this and decide to murder Karen in order to convince her father to stay quiet instead of, you know, killing Kup, the guy who spilled the beans to begin with. Kind of odd that these conspirators supposedly killed over 100 people to cover their tracks, but never went after the guy who was a highly respected columnist and TV personality It had the power to potentially blow the lid off the whole thing. The fact that Penn Jones Jr. could link the Kupcinet family to the Kennedy assassination over nothing more than the fact that Kup knew Jack Ruby 2 decades beforehand is pretty absurd. I'm sure Jack Ruby knew a lot of people throughout his life, but that doesn't mean he's going to tell all of them that he's involved in a plot to kill the president. In addition, in his book Forgive My Grief, Jones wrote that Karen made her anonymous phone call days before the assassination, when the records clearly show the call happened the very same morning, so that's already a major red flag about his research skills. Now, I will admit I do find the whole story about the anonymous female caller who predicted Kennedy's death to be very intriguing. I'm pretty sure the incident did happen, and the switchboard operators were telling the truth about what they heard, but it seems like everybody's impression at the time was that the caller was nothing more than a mentally disturbed woman who probably had no actual knowledge of the assassination, and it's just a bizarre coincidence that she made a wild prediction which somehow came true. But I just don't see how any reasonable person could possibly believe the caller was Karen Kupcinet, especially since both operators seem certain it was a middle-aged woman. Oxnard is over 50 miles away from Karen's apartment, and I just don't see why she would travel that distance and wait until the last minute to warn anybody about what was going to happen. Not to mention that she would then have to travel 50 miles back to West Hollywood before making another 2-hour drive to Palm Springs that night with Andrew Prine and 2 other friends. Yes, Prine said that Karen was pretty upset about the assassination, but so was the majority of the country. There's a difference between being upset because the president was murdered and being upset because you knew about it beforehand and were unable to prevent it. So logically, I think we can completely close the books on Karen's death being connected to the Kennedy assassination and explore this case from other angles. Really, when you eliminate the JFK conspiracy theories, this is a case which showcases an awful lot of warning signs of the victim either dying an accidental death or committing suicide. I've previously discussed the odd, rambling, handwritten notes found in Karen's apartment, and I think this particular sentence is pretty telling. My figure's fat, it will never be the way my mother wants it. Even though Karen's father was, by all accounts, a very well-liked and well-respected guy, and Karen seemed to have a good relationship with him, the same could not be said about her mother, Essie Kupcinet. She was known for being a loud, obnoxious, and foul-mouthed woman, and ever since Karen was a child, Essie gave off the impression of being a huge stage mom who wanted her daughter to become a star. Essie pushed Karen to break into acting, but the problem is that she wasn't overly talented. That's not to say Karen was a bad actress per se, but she had a rather limited range, and nothing about her really stood out. Because she came from an influential family, Karen was able to get a lot of meetings with prominent people both on Broadway and in Hollywood, but she rarely ever got substantive roles. Even though she was getting some roles on television, her acting career wasn't exactly setting the world on fire, and it was clear she was feeling immense pressure to live up to her mother's wishes. Right from the outset, Essie was obsessed with her daughter's weight, and introduced her to crash dieting and diet pills at age 13. It was clear that Karen never thought her weights or looks were good enough, and at her mother's encouragement, she even got some plastic surgery on her chin, nose, ears, and eyes. When you look at the circumstances, it's easy to see how Karen would end up abusing diet pills and other prescription drugs. Shortly before her death, we have an account of Karen showing up at the Goddard's dinner party while she was clearly under the influence of something and sharing a story about finding an abandoned baby on her doorstep, which turned out to be false. As odd as that story sounds, it's not hard to imagine why Karen dreamed it up. Remember, just 4 months earlier, Karen had traveled to Mexico to get an illegal abortion, and you can see how she might have felt guilt-ridden over this and concocted a fantasy story about rescuing an abandoned baby as her way of dealing with it. It makes twisted sense that she told this story to Andrew Prine, the father of her child, and the Goddards, who took her to Tijuana and paid for her abortion. And of course, upon Karen's death, there was the shocking revelation that she had constructed threatening notes and sent them both to Andy and herself, so she clearly couldn't deal with the fact that he wanted to date other women. It's clear that Karen was going through a lot of personal turmoil at this time, but in the end, this case pretty much wound up going against the norm for this type of investigation. In many of the cases I've covered on this podcast, The police were the ones who were quick to write off the victim's death as accidental or suicide, while their friends and family kept insisting it was foul play. But here, upon finding Karen's body, her friends seemed ready to accept that she took her own life or accidentally overdosed, but then the coroner discovered the broken hyoid bone in her throat, and the whole thing turned into a murder investigation. I will say that in spite of Karen's many personal problems, I have my doubt that this was a suicide, because I'm not sure what the method might have been. Since Karen had a lot of different drugs in her medicine cabinet, and some of their bottles were empty, you could easily assume that she swallowed a bunch of pills to take her own life. If that was the case, I have a feeling she would have vomited something up, but nothing was found at the scene, and I'm not sure if any traces of drugs were found in Karen's system. However, the biggest wildcard in this case is the competency of the coroner, Dr. Harold Cade. Now, the one person who seems most convinced that there was no foul play in Karen's case is noted author James Ellroy, who has written such popular crime fiction novels as L.A. Confidential and The Black Dahlia. In his book Crime Wave, Ellroy devoted an entire chapter to the Karen Cupsinet case and made some interesting discoveries in his research. Ellroy seemed intrigued by the fact that a book was found in Karen's apartment which was open to a particular page which stated that one should dance in the nude in order to free their inhibitions. Maybe the reason Karen's body was found in the manner it was because she decided to perform some nude dancing in the apartment that night, but then, possibly due to the fact that she was on drugs at the time, she slipped, fell, and hit her throat on something before landing face first on the couch. If Karen wasn't strangled to death, then this could be an alternate explanation to account for the broken hyoid bone in her throat. But the other alternate explanation was that Dr. Harold Cade was simply terrible at his job. Dr. Cade was known for being an alcoholic with a history of erratic behavior, so there's been some speculation that he either misdiagnosed the broken hyoid bone and came to the incorrect conclusion of homicide, or even worse, actually broke the hyoid bone himself during the autopsy. While performing another autopsy shortly after Karen's death, Cade allegedly told a colleague, "At least I didn't break the hyoid bone on this one." To give you an idea of Cade's credibility, in 1966, there were no less than 3 cases in which deceased victims were exhumed because the findings on Cade's original autopsies were challenged. In fact, a couple of innocent people actually wound up being wrongfully convicted of murder because of these errors, so Cade was ultimately forced to resign and wound up facing charges of gross negligence. Now, in spite of Ellroy's theories, the LAPD still considered Karen's death to be an unsolved murder. I do think that Ellroy's explanation that Karen fell over and crushed her throat on something while dancing in the nude is a bit of a stretch. I mean, I do think it's possible that Karen did accidentally fall over and broke her hyoid bone, but not because she was dancing. There was a towel found on the floor in Karen's bathroom, which seemed to suggest she showered shortly before her death. Since her bathrobe was draped over a chair, it's possible that Karen exited the bathroom after showering, but something happened before she had a chance to put the robe on. If Karen was high on drugs, she simply might have tripped or passed out, which caused her to land the wrong way and damage her throat. The other explanation, of course, is that Karen's death was an accidental overdose, and Dr. Cade accidentally broke her hyoid bone himself. In order to cover up his mistake, Cade ruled that Karen was strangled to death and never bothered to explore other possible explanations which didn't involve murder. This might be the reason we don't know specific details about the drugs Karen had in her system when she was found. I gotta say, when I first started delving into this case, my initial instinct was that there was no foul play, and this was nothing more than an overdose or a tragic accident, which became a homicide investigation because of an incompetent coroner. However, there are still some issues which bother me. Specifically, the fact that when Edward Rubin and Robert Hathaway left Karen's apartment that night, they were certain they locked the door behind them, but when the Goddards showed up 3 days later, the door was unlocked. Now, this might be a simple case of Rubin and Hathaway misremembering things or not locking the door as thoroughly as they thought. But if what they said was true, then this suggests that someone else entered Karen's apartment after they left. And since there were no signs of forced entry, Karen might have opened the door and let the person inside herself. The locked door detail is one of the reasons I'm inclined to think that neither Reuben or Hathaway had anything to do with their death, because if they just told the police that they left the door unlocked, then it's easier to believe that another suspect could have entered the apartment and killed Karen. Now, both men claim that they left because Karen kept falling asleep on the couch before going into her bedroom. This is why they decided to turn down the volume on the television, and since the TV was still running at a low volume 3 days later, it was probably never turned off. I have a feeling that Karen was probably sleeping in the bedroom until Andrew Prine woke her up when he called to check on her at midnight. Now that she was awake, Karen might have been compelled to go take a shower, and it was shortly after this when she unlocked the front door. Now, it seems unlikely that Karen would have answered the door in the nude, but she could have been dressed in her bathrobe when she opened the door and let someone inside. Events could have transpired which led to Karen removing her robe, or having it forcibly removed by the person who ultimately strangled her to death. Due to the state of decomposition on her body, I don't think they were able to determine if Karen was sexually assaulted, but that could have played a role in her murder. But who could the perpetrator have been? Well, of course, for years, there was a lot of suspicion about Andrew Prine, with the potential motive being that he snapped and killed Karen once he found out that she'd been sending him threatening notes. However, we know Andy was at his apartment at midnight when he phoned Karen, and Dr. K believes she was killed around 12:30 a.m., though given his serious credibility issues, I can't even be sure if that time of death is accurate. But if Karen was killed at 12:30, then this means Andy would have had to rush over to her apartment and murder her within a half hour before returning to his place and spending the next few hours hanging out with Reuben and Hathaway. That only makes logical sense if Karen said something to Andy during that phone call, which gave him the sudden impulsion to kill her. One thing I'm not entirely clear on is if Andy ever knew that Karen was pregnant with his child and had gone down to Mexico for an abortion. Given that Andy wasn't interested in a serious, exclusive relationship at this point, I don't think he would have been interested in being a father to Karen's child, so if she told him about the abortion over the phone, I'm not sure that would have been enough to compel him to murder her, unless she told him she was planning to blackmail him or something. I don't know, it's obvious that Karen was much more obsessive about Andy than he was of her, and even though they weren't in an exclusive relationship, Andy seemed to think highly enough of Karen to keep spending time with her, given that they went on an outing to Palm Springs together only 1 week earlier. I certainly don't think it's 100% impossible that Prine could have been the killer, but there's just no real motive, or any physical evidence such as fingerprints, which places him at the scene. I do think it's very telling that after Karen's parents spent the next few years essentially trying to curtail Prine's life by publicly branding him as a murderer, Cupp finally admitted in his autobiography that he believed Prine was innocent. It's not often you'll find a murder victim's family change their tune like that, so they must have had good reason to believe Prine had nothing to do with her death. Now, on the other hand, Karen's family felt much differently about David Lang, and on the surface, he seems like the most likely suspect. Lang lived in the apartment right below Karen, and claimed that he returned at around 12:30 a.m., the approximate time of Karen's death. By his own admission, Lang was pretty drunk. He had a notorious habit of walking into other people's apartments uninvited when he was intoxicated, and he flat out told someone he killed Karen, even though he later recanted and said he was just kidding. So I can definitely picture a scenario where a drunken Lang decides to knock on Karen's door late at night, and because he's her neighbor, she unlocks the door and lets him inside. Given Lang's inebriated state, any number of scenarios could have occurred which escalated out of control and led to him strangling Karen to death. But in spite of Lang's odd behavior, there are no fingerprints or any other piece of physical evidence which place him inside the apartment. I know Cupp alleged that Lang's family was influential enough to prevent him from being thoroughly investigated, and it is true that his sister Hope Lang was a very successful actress who had been nominated for an Academy Award 6 years earlier. David Lang died in 2006, so if he was responsible for Karen's death, he took that secret to his grave. Overall, I'd say I may be about 50-50 between Karen's death being some sort of accident or overdose, or foul play being involved. I'm not sure who the perpetrator might have been, but remember, there were a few unknown sets of prints found in the apartment. So the killer could have been some unknown person we don't even know about who happened to stop by Karen's door that night. But when you consider that the homicide ruling was made by a coroner so incompetent that his autopsies wound up getting multiple innocent people convicted of murders which never happened, I'm willing to believe that there was no murder in this particular case. The only thing I'm 100% sure about is that her death had nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination, and I think all those conspiracy theories have really muddied the waters in this case and provided an unnecessary distraction. When you look at Karen Kupcinet's life as a whole, you can see that the source of a lot of her issues was the enormous pressure she faced from her mother to become a star, which caused her to lead a self-destructive lifestyle. So regardless of whether or not Karen was murdered, this is still a really sad story. As far as I know, this is still technically an open case with the LAPD, so even though 54 years have passed, if you happen to have any information on the unsolved death of Karen Kupcinet, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give a shout out to all my supporters from the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. We also received a very generous donation this week from a listener named Megan, so thank you very much, Megan. And before we close things off, I'd like to play you a promo for a new true crime podcast called The Hidden Staircase.
Bring out your inner detective with every episode of The Hidden Staircase podcast, where I, Sammy, deliver stories and true cases of mystery and murder. You can join us at the Hidden Staircase discussion group on Facebook, or you can like us on Twitter at The Hidden, and we'll talk about everything mystery and murder. You can also go to accproductions.org/hiddenstaircase to learn more about the podcast and the episodes we've discussed. Don't forget to lock your doors and hold tight to your flashlight.
Just need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who is responsible for our eerie music score. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or any of the cases we feature with myself or your fellow listeners, feel free to join and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. Earlier this month, we also opened a new online store and are now selling Trail Went Cold merchandise, such as t-shirts, mugs, and stickers, so feel free to visit our website at trailwentcold.com and click the store button if you wish to purchase anything. Christmas is now only 1 month away, so our merchandise might make a very nice gift for the True Crime Podcast fans you know. And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website, so if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm